Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to another episode of Early Work. That's right, it's a lockdown special. We are in quarantine. I come to you recording this live from under a blanket in my own office. Call it an office, just a little room, tiny little room in my house next to the toilet. On this week's episode is Dan Schreiber. You probably know Dan Schreiber. He's from No Such Thing as a Fish. That's one of the biggest podcasts. He's hilarious. He's one of the most interesting men I have ever met in my life, okay? He's the king of anecdotes, and he really represents that on this episode. It's ridiculous. Every time he tells a story, you think it can't be topped, and then he tops it himself within 10 seconds. And just as you're thinking, God, more stories, more anecdotes, please, Dan, he then brings out his early work, which is just as impressive. Absolutely sensational. I wish we could have seen it live when he actually performed it. Hopefully someday we will when he reprises it. Another little thing I want to mention is that during this interview, Dan mentioned a band in Australia called The Angels and a man called Doc Neeson, who was his friend's dad. Now, at the time, I bottled mentioning that I know about The Angels because my dad grew up in Australia, and I know that The Angels have this amazing song called Am I Ever Gonna See Your Face Again? And when they do it live in Australia, you know what Australians are like, they go, am I ever gonna see your face again? And the whole audience go, no way, get fucked, fuck off. Right, you can find that on Spotify if you just search The Angels and then look for Am I Ever Gonna See Your Face Again? It's in their top tracks, the live version. Wait till you get to the chorus. I think it's the third chorus in, and the whole crowd sing that. It's absolutely delightful. It's such a shame I didn't bring that up to Dan because I panicked and thought, oh, maybe they're not called The Angels. Maybe I've got it wrong. But go and listen to it. It's amazing, right? And listen to it after you've listened to this podcast. Listen to this podcast first, then give it 5 stars, and then go and listen to The Angels. You're going to enjoy it. Anyway, hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will see you on the next side. Joining me on Early Work this week in a quarantine across the line special is Mr. Dan Schreiber. Hello, Dan.
Hey, mate.
And if you notice any kind of satellite delay, listeners, it's because there literally is one. I asked that question 25 minutes ago.
Hello, Reese. It's nice to be here.
Lovely stuff. For those of you who don't know Dan, he's probably best known for when we lived together in Edinburgh in 2014.
2014. Yeah, that is how I put it on all the sort of posters I do for my podcast, Fish. They want to mention the awards. I say, no. It's the shared household with Reese James.
We lived together in 2014. Actually, that I've talked to you about this before, but that living with you was such a great experience because you didn't get swept up in all the Edinburgh-ness of it all, as far as I was aware. So basically, for the listeners that don't know, is when you're in Edinburgh, particularly doing your debut show, which we were both doing that year, you get really obsessed with like reviews and who's coming and like, am I going to become a star? And it really weighs down on you and ruins your life. But Dan, I would just wake up and then go into the kitchen and you would just be in the kitchen like on your laptop going, oh my God, there's a 95-year-old ghost hunter in Canada. I'd be on my laptop going, oh, Steve Bennett thinks I'm shit at comedy. He's even giving me 2 stars. He'd be like, yeah, but check out this guy. And he was so enthusiastic about all this stuff.
Yeah, the difference was, though, is that you had a good show and I didn't. So I arrived going, well, this isn't going to go well. I'll just enjoy it. Whereas you genuinely had a good show.
You did very well. With the Pensioner Ghost Hunter crowd, your show went down exceptionally.
Oh, it was huge. Yeah, still is. I'm still doing that one show all over the world.
That was a real example, wasn't it? Didn't you tell me about a really old ghost hunter? Was it a ghost hunter?
There was a ghost hunter that I discovered. So Hans Holzer, who is the ghost hunter who Ghostbusters is based on. Dan Aykroyd was obsessed with him. Yeah, and this guy was incredible. He was he wrote all the sort of seminal ghost hunting books. He turned it into journalism. He was a sort of like John Ronson or Louis Theroux of the ghost hunting world back in the day. And he passed away actually it was a couple of decades ago probably now. He's been dead for a while. But his daughter has got his talent, she says, that she can go and do that. So she does ghost hunting tours in America, in New York. And as part of it, she channels her father. So he's now a ghost hunter. He's part of the ghost hunting in these houses, for ghosts, as a ghost, yeah. It's an amazing...
Not only is it a pensioner who's a ghost hunter, it's literally a dead man who is now
he's a ghost hunter.
That is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I presume, to be honest, I was about to turn the whole podcast into being about that. I'm assuming you've already done a podcast about this, as is the nature of your job.
No, I don't think I've spoken about it before. I found out in the course of it that Dan Aykroyd genuinely believes in ghosts as he does in aliens as well. But he claims one night that he was in bed and he noticed that a ghost was laying next to him in the bed. And he said, I thought, what do I do? Do I freak out? Do I get out? He decided instead to spend the night with the ghost. So he spooned the ghost. He spent the night spooning this male ghost in bed with him. I don't know if he found out his name or anything. I think he was gone in the morning. But he's fully into it. So Ghostbusters is not a parody. It's him living out a fantasy.
And it turns out that all the porn parodies of Ghostbusters are also true. It's also based on something that happened to Dan Aykroyd. Good to know.
He's just writing under pseudonyms.
Now, Dan, if I had to guess what you were like at school, and I do, because it's the first format point of the show, I have written... Now, I know that you went to schools in different countries, right? So you went to one in Australia. Did you go to school in Hong Kong? You were born in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I was born in Hong Kong. So my first school up until 12 was Hong Kong.
So you went to international school. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I don't know what that experience is like. So these guesses are potentially based too much on what British schools are like. But what I've put are, I think you were the rarest of school paradoxes, being nerdy but popular. I reckon you were a teacher's pet who didn't get bullied, which is still part of the paradox. I'd say you've got such an inquisitive mind and an infectious sense of enthusiasm. I think you broke down the barriers of what being a cool kid in school means. And I'd say any kind of school leadership position, I'd think you'd have been a shoo-in for. And just a little bit of detail, I think you're the sort of person who would have had an over-the-shoulder satchel bag before anyone else. Am I correct?
You're correct on everything but the satchel bag.
Oh, you really seem like someone who breaks new ground in the backpack game.
Yeah, I know. I wish I did. I'm thinking now that I cocked up, but that's so weird. Everything else you said, even though it's an asshole thing to admit it, is completely correct. I was the nerdy guy who was liked by the older kids and the kids below, and just everything you said. How did you get that?
Because that's what you like now. I'm not changed anything. You're this nerdy guy that everyone loves. So I just went, what was it like at school? Probably that.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was like that. I mean, in Hong Kong, it was, you know, there was a thing of, I was the only Caucasian in my year. Everyone was either half white and then half Chinese or Japanese or one of my best friends, Max, Maximilian, he used to call himself Max a Billion at school. So he was really cool. He was half Japanese. He is, rather, half Japanese, half German. And he has an amazing thing where, because it was very confusing, Hong Kong, with all these different cultures coming together. his mum, who speaks Japanese, doesn't speak English. She speaks broken English and doesn't speak German. His dad speaks German and broken English, but no Japanese. And Max speaks English, but neither Japanese nor German. So no one in his family can communicate with each other perfectly.
So that's
the weirdest scenario.
No one in his family has called him out for calling himself Maximilian, because no one knows what he's fucking saying. if he was in a family with anyone who speaks his language, they'd go, don't do that, mate. I mean, obviously, don't call yourself Maximilian. Amazing. I mean, this is like one of your stories. This is a ghost hunter, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a ghost hunter, yeah.
Maximilian, no, so who doesn't communicate with his own parents because they will speak different languages.
It's completely true. I mean, there was another kid at my school who's one of my best friends. So Max actually and I were in a band later with this other guy, Amrish.
What was the band called, please?
We were called The Art of Loving.
How old were you at the time?
25.
Oh, mate. Oh,
yeah,
no.
We took it off. It was a philosophy book that was in the toilet. I mean, it was a joke, the band name. We were also called Bluey Music and Cien, which is a Chinese word. But Amrish, who was the drummer in the band, and Amrish, incredible sort of drummer, but in terrible memory. He can never remember where we were in the song. Like, he just didn't know our songs. And these were songs that we wrote together. So we'd get to the end of the song, and he'd still be playing. He's the only one still playing. And we're like, Amrish, why are you playing? And he would say, oh, I thought we were at the bridge. So
that's absolutely insane. Well, I've never heard of anything like that.
But he, in Hong Kong, his family is from India. His parents are both from there, and all his family who were in Hong Kong from there. But he went to a German school, and he speaks with an American accent. So he's just culturally, he was all over the shop, you know, living in a Chinese country. And that was that whole grouping. So I was weirdly a minority in Hong Kong because I was a full Caucasian. Everyone else in my year, barring maybe one or two people of 60 kids, were half Chinese, half Japanese or so on. So that was a really odd thing.
How does that blend with trying to be creative at school? Like, are you encouraged, because it's an international school, but you're in Hong Kong, are you encouraged to try and make things, draw, write anything? I know that was a young age, or is it more about education?
No, in Hong Kong, it was really about academia, but I never really cared about that. I had two parents who didn't go to university, didn't really do much schooling. They're both hairdressers. And they met in Hong Kong and set up a salon. It was a very bizarre place to do that. And so education to them, they were more just like, just have fun, do what you want. Mm. But they spent a fortune on our education there. And the school, for some reason, they just really liked us being creative. Me particularly. They just let me do whatever I wanted to do. So we started like a school comic that, you know, parodied the teachers and stuff
How
like that.
How old were you then?
Eight or nine.
Wow, that's pretty precocious.
I was really, straight away, I was really into comedians, and I used to read, like, I was looking back at all my early Halloween costumes, and they're all me dressed as Charlie Chaplin or Wayne from Wayne's World, or one year I went as Dame Edna Everidge. Totally failed. I ended up looking like my English teacher.
But that blends in really with your comics. Hideous. You're just parodying the teachers. This is what they come to expect of you at that stage, Dan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was quite... It was quite young I was kind of doing...
What was the... did the comic have a name?
No, I can't remember. I know who I did it with. It was a guy called Daniel Chan, who I was obsessed with. He was, like, the cool Chinese kid. There was one thing that I really was into was I really wanted to be Chinese. I still feel more comfortable around Chinese people. Like, when you grow up in a culture and you're not something from that culture, I was a white kid, I was just like, man, I just wish I was Chinese. Why couldn't I have been Chinese? Like, it's so much cooler. This is just fucking cooler. And I'm this weird white kid. And Daniel Chan was nerdy as hell, but had that coolness about him, and coolness to me, in the way that you kind of identify with other comics. I was like, oh yeah, this guy's awesome. And he had a bowl haircut, which I really wanted.
Right. I think I had one of them back in the day.
Yeah, I had it for years and years. I've lost it as I got older. My parents actually, because as I say, they were hairdressers, they used to give me a bowl haircut because for a weird reason, up until I was about eight or nine, I didn't have a full forehead. The insides of my hair came really close into my forehead. I had like a 2-point forehead.
You're one of those maniacs.
Yeah.
So you just had a really low hairline, a really naturally
super low
hairline.
Yeah, but it came in on the sides as well. So I had just like a little rectangle in the middle.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And to be honest, I never used to notice those people. But as my hairline recedes drastically as I get closer to my 30s, I've started to really become aware and extremely jealous of all of those people.
Yeah, well, I've only in the last 10 years got an actual like normal forehead. So that's a really lucky thing because I've receded like crazy if you consider how small
the space was originally. You've got quite a low hairline. You've got like a nicely positioned hairline, but that's you fully receding now. That's you in old age. You're an old man with this perfect hairline. That's it. You got to start there. God. And it's so funny that you were looking at that going, I wish I was Chinese and had a forehead. The grass is always greener, isn't it?
Is it?
So then you had your hairdresser parents, who, by the way, must have been absolutely gutted to have a freak like you as a kid. All they want is a kid with normal hair so they can do crazy stuff with their hair, and they've got this kid who, oh god, he's got too much hair, there's too much to play with here, so they had to give you a bowl cut so that it would come and cover that hairline. Was that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. And it was horrible for them because they were in Hong Kong. They moved at a time when it still was kind of classic Chinese haircuts in Hong Kong, and suddenly Madonna got massive. Like, out of nowhere, Madonna hit Asia, and everyone wanted Madonna's hair. They wanted the styles, and that was the first time, really, where hair just suddenly went into the great sort of fashions that they are now in Hong Kong. And my parents were the only Western hairdressers who'd open up a salon, so everyone came to them. So they were suddenly doing the hair of the stars, and they were invited to all the parties. Wow. And you know, when Madonna came in town, they would do Madonna's hair, or they did Barbara Bush's hair, or you know, Dad would do Ringo Starr's beard, like stuff like that. If these people came in,
God,
and I'd be around with a bowl haircut, just you know,
and everyone would come into the hairdresser and point at you and go, "I want what he's got."
Who's that cool kid?
I want the Dan Schreiber, please.
Yeah. Can you glue hair to my forehead and get it to shrink to his level?
God, yeah. So they have some big names. So did your parents have a wall where they were photographed with all these people?
No, they never did that. I always really regretted that. Because
they never had
a
wall of fame in their hairdressers. They never bothered.
I think there was one photo, which was with my dad with Dr. Ruth.
Of all the names you've listed... to go, this is the one I'm taking a picture of. I can't miss this opportunity.
The only other one we have is of my dad with Imelda Marcos, because he franchised the salon to the Philippines. And my dad's got a really beautiful voice. He used to do sort of karaoke versions where he would sing Bee Gees songs, and he could sing like a Bee Gee. He would sing like Andy Gibb, who was the fourth one who OD'd quite early. So everyone's like, wow, you sound like Andy Gibb. And in the Philippines, because I guess they didn't have many people to put on their sort of Jonathan Ross style shows, there was a guy called Johnny Litton, and he used to get my dad to come on and just sing karaoke songs on his primetime Philippines show. And Imelda Marcos was watching it one night, and she saw my dad doing it, and he got a letter saying, I loved your singing Bee Gees songs. I would like you to come to my house and sing Bee Gees with me. So my dad, you can't say no to Imelda Marcos. She's too powerful there. She's got too many mafia-esque connections. So he used to go all the time to Imelda Marcos's house and just sing karaoke with her and then leave again. And that's the only other Wall of Fame thing that I've ever seen in
that
our
is
house.
Absolutely insane. Everything you've said to me so far in this episode puts every other guest to shame. The other people's anecdotes are like, oh yeah, when I was at school, I lost my bag and my folder fell in the puddle. You have come on and gone, sorry, my dad was forced at gunpoint to sing karaoke with Imelda Marcos after cutting Paul McCartney's hair or whatever. It's ridiculous. And there's a fucking ghost hunter. Every bit of information is mental. I was in a band called The Art of Loving. I was 25. I mean, we're straight in on this. That's why you've got to do these recordings over the internet. Because suddenly, you're in the comfort of your own home. You're willing to tell me these things. If we were in person, there's no chance you'd have told me this. You'd have just gone, yeah, you know, I did all right in my GCSEs. And that would have been the end of the podcast. But this, I can't believe it.
I think this is, I mean, this is just Hong Kong. This is, you know.
We're not even in Australia yet. We haven't even gone to Australia yet.
I haven't even touched Australia yet. Yeah. It was really weird. When my dad saw, so he said one of the weirdest things Imelda Marcos said to him was she complained going, you know, Roger, my dad's called Roger. I get so upset everyone always goes on about my shoes, my massive collection of shoes. And he thought it was like, oh, okay, yeah, because you stole millions from the country. And that's, you know, it's a sign of how well you were doing publicly to have that many shoes. But she followed it up by going, yeah, they never talk about the fact that I have the world's largest collection of silverware. That's what you want? And he was really nervous when he met her because in Hong Kong, he used to have these two buddies who came in all the time who were, they would come to the salon, get their haircut, and they were just such cool guys that my dad would end up going out for drinks with them and they would party a lot. And they used to come into town once a month. And my dad one day said that he was waiting for them because they had a booking to come in. And the day before, one of the guys came in and said, Roger, I need to talk to you. This is a bit serious. Can we go somewhere else? And he went, yeah, sure. So they sat down and he said, I just got to let you know that the guy you've been hanging out with and me, we're not who you think we are. This guy has been one of the biggest drug traders in and out of Hong Kong for many, many years. And I've been undercover with, and I can't remember if it was the CIA or the FBI, or it was one of those big organizations. I've been undercover this whole time trying to get him. And yesterday we finally got him properly. Like we've busted him. He's now in jail, or he's, you know, waiting in a prison somewhere. I need to let you know because you're going to be investigated now because we've been hanging out with you. But I know that you had nothing to do with this, so this is absolutely fine. But you need to know that you're about to be investigated. Now, this guy then went on to discover the Marcos millions that were missing. He was the guy who tracked down where all this missing money had went. So my dad was convinced, as he was driving to Imelda Marcos's house, that she knew that he was connected with this guy, this investigator, who had busted, opened the case of the Marcos millions, and was going to have him killed. So as he was on his way to do karaoke, and during karaoke, the whole thing was, am I going to be killed, literally, by Marcos for this connection? It was a very weird thing for him to...
I bet going through his head at the time, he was thinking, oh, am I going to die with my son only ever having a bowl cut? And no, I didn't get to do a single good style on him all this
time.
A picture
of Dr. Ruth.
Just all I've got is a picture of Dr. Ruth, the son with a bowl cut. And yes, I'm involved in the discovering of the millions, but now I have to pay for it. That is absolutely amazing. Now also, because when you go to the hairdresser, the conversation, a little bit dry, right, when you get your hair cut, quite often. Not for me, if you're listening, Paul Sweeney. He's my friend and he cuts my hair.
Oh, yeah, Paul.
Love chatting to you. But before I went to Paul, when it was strangers cutting my hair, always a bit dry. Where are you going on holiday? That's the cliche, isn't it? Oh, what are you up to today? All that sort of stuff. Now, when people are visiting your parents' salon, there's some stories. They got some stuff to say. I mean, I don't know how that's going to come up organically. Wait, are you going anywhere nice on your holiday? Yeah, going to Hong Kong. Oh, funny you should mention Hong Kong. Oh, this haircut's going to take 3 hours, but it's going to be absolutely enthralling.
Yeah. Manila, you say? Well, a contact there if you need some singing. they do have crazy stories. It was a crazy time. Hong Kong in the 80s was a really mad place. It was so affluent. It was so bizarre. It was cultures were just smashing into each other. And it was a billionaire's land. Like the school we went to, we never knew this at the time, but there were people in our classes who are the heirs to the, you know, my sister's best friend, Sammy, her dad, or rather her grandfather, runs the Shangri-La hotels globally. We had no idea. Like we found this all out when we were in our 20s because you just didn't talk about it. We were just being kids. I don't know why. We just weren't curious about what anyone's parents did.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I grew up thinking, well, no one knows what their dad does.
Yeah.
Unless your dad is a postman and then it's obvious. But if your dad's just like, oh, he puts on a suit and he leaves the house, you just go, well, no one knows. No one knows what his job is. He could be absolutely anything.
Yeah,
That could be a lawyer or it could be a prostitute, for all I know. And that's how I found out how my parents met. If you were at a school that was mostly focused on academia, but you were doing things like you created a comic and stuff like that, and we never
released it. We never finished it, I should just say.
Oh, so you didn't put it out?
No, we never put it out.
So it's just for your mates to look at?
No, we didn't even get that far.
It was literally just the two of you?
Yeah, we were sat in a room, the headmaster's room. He gave us the room to do it in, and we just couldn't bash out enough of it for it to be released.
Oh, that's not normally a problem, though. You've been to the Edinburgh Fringe. You've seen what people are up to. You don't need to have enough of anything. This format alone, There's not really enough here. So when you were, you then moved to Australia and you went to high school in Australia?
Yeah, so I was 13 when I arrived.
And was that a more encouraging environment to do stuff like creative writing?
Yeah, so I went to a Rudolf Steiner school, which is it's a hippie school, basically. It was set up by this guy, Rudolf Steiner, in Austria, and he really believed it was more about sort of your aura and your passage through earth and understanding plants and all that sort of stuff. It was so hippie vibes, and I got there, it was year seven. I had a really odd experience, actually. I was very scared of white people when I arrived in Australia, as I was always whenever I visited England, because I'd never been around that many white people in one big grouping, right? And so I had this weird kind of unique experience, I would say, of walking into a room when I was a kid, a new school room, being the only kid who was afraid of the same ethnicity in the room. I always sympathize with how hard that is for if you're in a predominantly white society and you walk in and you're not white, how really intimidating that is and scary. I was petrified of the guy who it turned out was the kid that everyone bullied in the class. I picked him thinking this guy's going to kick my ass straight away. And it took quite a few years for me to get over that sort of fear of walking into a room full of just white people. Because
You thought this boy... You saw a guy, just to clarify, and went, that guy's going to kick my ass. And it turned out he was the guy that everyone kicked his ass.
Yeah, yeah. Like everyone...
What a judging
every
character.
Every single person. I completely picked the wrong person.
The exact wrong person to be scared of.
Yeah, and then this other guy came up to me and said, you're called Dan? I'm called Dan too. There can't be two Dans in this class. And I thought, oh, well, great. Now he's going to kick my ass as well. He's
and then
still
you
my,
were like,
one of my...
I've got just the thing. Dan a billion.
Yeah, it took a long time to get over. But immediately the school was really cool. It was a hippie school. It was set in the bush in Australia. It was in the city, like across the bridge towards the northern beaches, but it was down a hill and we were just surrounded in trees, and there was some of the classrooms were raised huts and stuff like that. And that was the place where they valued creativity over academia. I was very lucky to be sent there, I think, because all the stuff that I would do was... I just wanted to write funny stuff at that point. I was really obsessed at 13 with Spike Milligan and Blackadder and Fry and Laurie and all these huge British influences. And then on the other side, the Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton and Seinfeld and Friends and all those sitcoms that were coming out. I, from a very young age, was totally clicked into that. And so when we used to write sort of assignments for English or science, I used to just put jokes in there. And I used to get marks back from the teachers saying, I've given you a higher mark. You got a lot of stuff wrong, but you made me laugh at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was trying to mark this. And that kind of encouraged me. And I went on with that. So I remember specifically writing a analysis of Sylvia Plath's Ariel. But I interpreted it as if she was talking about the Little Mermaid as opposed to the actual subject matter. And it was so weird. It actually really lent itself to the comparisons. And she gave me an A+ for it. And I used to fuck everyone off because they were writing proper responses to it that you should be doing.
That's
and I
the
was
thing
dicking
that would,
about.
Get you suspended in my school.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the difference with Steiner. It really is a weird education. It gets a lot of shit. If you look at it online, everyone hates it. But I think they're confusing it with... because it has this kind of spiritual idea behind it. And everyone thinks that when you're a kid and you go to it, they're brainwashing you into thinking to think like that. And I really always think people who say that aren't giving kids enough credit for intelligence, because you don't buy into that stuff. You arrive and you're like, great, you mean we can dick about a bit more? That's the side I want. I'm not going to suddenly start wearing Hessian bags and, you know, going around dancing with poles, which was one of our classes, by the way. We had an actual lesson called Eurythmy, which is a dance that Rudolf Steiner created. So you spend the hour with a single metal pole dancing and moving it in different positions.
Which, by the way, is now everyone's home workout. Yes. Currently, the amount of people doing that on YouTube videos to go, you can just do it with body weight. Look, just get the end of your Hoover. Just get a broom and just dance around like Steiner. Did we all go to that hippie school? That's mad.
It's finally come in.
That's a man mad on power. If he's just gone, it's almost like it sounds to me, I've only just heard of this man, like he's created a school just to get more people doing the dance he invented. It seems like his main passion was the dance all along. And he's gone, oh, no one's doing it. I know. I'll put it on the curriculum.
Yeah. Let me just format an entire school system around it. It was a weird thing. I've never properly looked into Eurythmy, but you were given a gold pole and you would walk back and forth. It wasn't quick. It wasn't strenuous. It was very simple moves. And we used to be taught by a guy called Mr. Can you say teachers' names on a show like this? Is it?
I wouldn't worry about it, mate. We don't have the listenership for it to be an issue.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So Mr. he used to have a bit of anger about him, and I think it was largely because, and he was very open with us. We had a few vasectomies done.
Sorry. What? What did you just say?
So, well, what is it when you cut off so that you can't...
Did you say that he had a few vasectomies done?
Yeah.
Right, sorry. I it must be the internet connection, because I thought you said we had had a few vasectomies done. As if you just told me this school was not a cult, and now you're telling me they're giving vasectomies to children.
Yeah, no.
Why a few?
Well, because him and his wife, this is gossip mongering here. He told it to me personally, but I feel like over the years I might have translated this. But he and his wife had some kids and they didn't want any more. So he got the snip. Then they decided they wanted kids. So he got reattached. And then they decided, actually, we don't want any more kids. So he got the snip again. And I think there might have been one more reattachment in there. Yeah. But he used to get in a lot of trouble. He kept swearing at us all the time. He threw one of my friends, Dominic, out the window one time because
this guy really doesn't want kids.
he was an interesting character, and he used to have to swap his swearing for marsupials, which was a very bizarre thing. So he would go like, "Yo, wombat!" He would just yell just these very bizarre curses at us. Dancing was a big part of our school, and the teachers let me write stuff. And the thing I'm going to talk about later in the show was a thing that I got to write, star, and direct as a result of us having so many music teachers who arrived at the school and left and arrived and left, that we finally had a British teacher. This was in the space of one academic year, who arrived and said, it's unfair for me to put you through the exams. You haven't had a consistent teacher. You haven't really learned anything. Why don't we do a project instead? And I said, well, I could write this thing. And that's what we... What I'll talk about later is what we ended up making.
Let's talk about it now. What is it?
It's a musical. It was a music class. We needed something that was music-based, but we couldn't think what it was. And I think in a group chat, I said, hey, why don't we do a play? But, well, we'll do a musical. Let's do that. And everyone got excited by that, but no one really was interested in writing it. And I was very much obsessed with The Goon Show and Blackadder and stuff at that point. So I was like, oh, can I have a bash at it? And they all said yes. So we had to think of the idea, and we based it on... So I was in a band at school as well, and there was a guy
As you know, name of that band, please.
It was Dime Cross Red.
Dime Cross Red. What does that
mean? Yeah, cross with a K. I think we wanted something that sounded like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and also something that was like the Beastie Boys. It was with two guys, Dan, who I told you before, threatened me because I had the same first name.
So this guy, he thinks the school's not big enough to have two Dans, but a two-person band is.
Yeah. So he was originally in a
band. I mean,
band
that's the sort of madness that you get from dancing around with a gold stick for the whole day for 10 years.
Yeah. He's really... So as I say, he's still one of my best friends. We lived in London for many years together. So his dad was one of the biggest rock stars ever in Australia, who sadly passed away a few years ago, but he was called Doc Neeson. And he was part of a band called The Angels, who at the time were bigger in their heyday than AC/DC and all these other bands.
Right.
So he had a real he had a rock and roll attitude about him. He would walk around being like, I'm the son of a fucking rock star. And so that's what, but he was joking, he said, when he said that Dan thing to me. But obviously I was scared because I was in a class full of white people and I was trying not to shit myself. So I missed the joke probably. But so he was in the band. My friend Xander was in the band. Xander, who went under the name DJ Comma, was his name. He was a DJ.
Okay, but he took his time.
Yeah, took his time.
He paused. He like pauses. Every now and then he'd just stop a track just for a little bit and then start it again. Lovely stuff. Sorry, mate. I've been self-isolating for a long time. I've basically gone fully insane at this point. I've not attempted a joke for a long time. That's the best I can do. DJ Comma, hey, what can awesome. I do with that? Oh, turns out fucking nothing. Continue, please.
I was. My name was Frisco. I went as Frisco.
Why is that?
I don't know. It was a Marx Brothers tribute, but I couldn't work out where I got Frisk from. But there you go, Frisco. and then this other guy called Simon Jankelson. And Simon Jankelson, well, Jankelson, Maze, rather.
But great name already. Doesn't
great
need,
name.
Doesn't need a stage name.
Yeah, great name. And he arrived in the school as a... He came from the eastern suburbs of Sydney, which is like Bondi Beach area, and he'd gone to school with a bit more of a crowd that were, I would say, a bit more rough. He called himself a homie. It's what we in Australia used to call kids who would wear their trousers low and like take your money on the street. They were homies. And like, I don't know what it was here. I don't know what you call it here, but do you call it homies as well? Criminal. He was, but like, this was, homie was like, he came from a rich family. So it wasn't like, it was just a sort of way of life. You sort of were on the streets. So he came into the school like that. And we kind of gradually broke him out of it by taking the piss out of it. And the way we took the piss out of it was we would always take his surname and create this character where he would go, Jenkinson says, you best be doing this thing to me or something like that. And he would always laugh at that. And eventually he took that character on himself. And he would always say, well, Jenkinson's not happy with that. He always, if we're in band practice, we'd hit a chord. And he goes, Jenkinson doesn't like that chord. And it sort of became him as opposed to it being a parody anymore. He sort of just became Jenkinson. So the musical idea I proposed was Jenkinson the musical. And he's the lead character in this musical. And so the story that we built up behind this musical was there's a crisis on Earth where... there's a moment in history where evil can reign if a concert doesn't happen. This specific concert has to happen. God is aware that this might happen, and the devil's trying to work out how he can make it happen, stop the concert, and take over the universe. He can't go up onto Earth because if he goes up onto Earth, he's going to be detected by God. So he has to send his long-lost son, who he's paid no attention to, called Draxley, up to Earth to try and capture everyone who's involved in the concert's voice in a jar. And by stopping their voices, the concert can't go on. So God suddenly sees that everyone's losing their voices. So he employs Jenkinson, Lord Mechanic of Music, to go down and investigate what's going on. And that's the basic plot of the...
Amazing. I mean, it's amazing. There are musicals in the West End that are less thought out than that.
Well, the idea was nice, but the writing was terrible.
It's got a real Tenacious D sound to it.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder if I was listening to Tenacious D at that time. I must have been, really.
The devil trying to stop this concert. Maybe it's just Jack Black, because there's slight School of Rock aspects to it in there as well. And did it actually get performed in the school?
Yeah, it did once. We did one performance of it, and it was... So the guy who came in, the teacher, was called Christian Lillycrap, and he was our music teacher from Britain, right?
Lillycrap.
Yeah, Lillycrap.
He must have been bullied.
He immediately went, call me Christian. So we never...
Yeah, you would have to, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we never really got to his surname.
Maybe that's what all those teachers are. All those teachers going, but you could just call me James. Is it because my name is James Dong.
Yeah.
My name is Philip Massive Schlong, but just call me Phil.
he was it's an interesting thing, because like when you think back on this stuff, like I was thinking about this play, and I had to write to my mum, who's living in Sydney with my family, and say, can you dig this up for me, because I'm going to talk about it. And I was thinking, Christian, actually, was the that teacher. We all have that teacher. This was the guy. This was the pivotal moment for me, because I'd never done anything like this. And he said, okay, go for it. And that Little Britain sketch. I wrote all the songs. I wrote all the lyrics. I wrote the script. I directed it. I starred in it as well as one of the lead characters.
Power mad.
Yeah. Well, I played God in the musical. I played the role of God. And so full title of the play, by the way, was Jenkelson the Musical, brackets, Black Plague Charlie Has Come to Town Again. I think that was the exact title of the play.
So say again, Jenkelson the Musical.
Yep, brackets, or Oh No, Black Plague Charlie's Come to Town. So I wrote it in this kind of feverish, I stayed at home, and I think I had a week to write it. And so I stayed at home, I wrote it, and I sent in the bits of paper to Sashi, who was my really close friend, and she typed it up. And it was really rude. Like, it was really, really rude. There was a lot of adult humor in there, which you could not perform to a school. And as a result, Christian, who had just arrived at the school as a teacher, I swear to God, this is true, his hair went gray during the process of this, because he was so nervous he was going to be fired for being the person who put on this play. And we rehearsed it for about 2 months, and we were going to do one performance on a Saturday to all the parents and whoever wanted to come. So it was out of school hours. And then a week before we were meant to do it, Jenkelson gets in a fight with the teacher on the drive leading out of the school and gets expelled.
Oh my God.
Our teacher, Mr. Naylor, said to us he can't be a part of the play. So there was suddenly a moment where we were going to have to do the play where someone else was going to have to come in and be Jenkelson, as opposed to Jenkelson himself, because he was playing himself. And we all said, no, we'd rather not do the play. We had a real Dead Poets Society moment, where I'd been taken away by this teacher, and he said, I need your support in this meeting, because you're the big person behind this, you're the director and so on. If you're on my side, then we can get this done in time, and we'll spend extra time in rehearsal and stuff. And I said, I just don't know how I'll respond to this. And then we're in the meeting, I said, I'm afraid, I think we should stop. And one by one, everyone was like, I'm not going to do it if Jenkelson's not doing it. I'm not doing it if it's not doing it. Yeah.
Amazing.
And then, and this is how good Steiner was, this school. Mr. Naylor then went, that was beautiful. We're doing the play. Simon could come back.
What? He could come back.
He didn't come back. He was still expelled, but he was allowed on the premises for this one occasion. This, yeah, exactly. A play dedicated
sending
to him
off. Oh my God.
What a send off.
Imagine getting expelled, and then you literally end your school career with your name, the musical, days after being expelled. Oh, that is absolutely inconceivable. So what do you have? You have the scripts of this musical, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So I got sent the scripts. I've sent you a few screen grabs of it. So maybe you can find the one that says Jenkelson the Musical at the top.
What do you want me to...
You can do all the dialogue for this first bit. This is a voiceover, and I can just do the stage directions.
Okay, so I'll be the voice, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, you'll be the voice.
What should we do? We're just doing Act 1.
Act 1, scene 1.
Okay,
yeah.
Jenkelson the Musical, written by Dan Schreiber, Act 1, Scene 1.
Okay, so curtains open. It's a completely dark stage. No lights are on. Music is playing in the background, sort of godly-like music.
In the beginning was the word of God, which oddly enough was eyebrow, and hence the creation of planet Earth. On the first day, God said, let there be light.
Middle of stage, light comes on.
On the second day, God said, let there be plants and animals.
Right hand of the stage, lights come on, a separate spotlight to show a pot plant with a flower in it on the ground, and a robotic pig comes out from the side saying oink.
On the third day, God created man.
Left hand stage light comes on, with a fully naked man crouching down. And my friend Carl did that. He was naked on stage, crouched down. He goes on to play a leading character called Draxley, but this was his first moment on stage.
True, it was a hideously ugly man, but still, nonetheless, a man. And on the fourth day, God rested, which is the biblical term for, right, can't be bothered anymore with this one. Let's play around with Mars. But one aspect was never covered by the Bible, music. And what
Not true. Of course it was covered. Yeah.
music and what part it played on the history of the world. So here, for the first time, is the lost tale of Jenkelson, Lord Mechanic of Music.
And then we go into a big song, which was it was Jenkelson, the savior of our world, Jenkelson. Da, 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 da. And then we wrote.
Where did you get that tune from?
I think it just came to me. I don't know where that is.
So is that the actual tune, or just the one that came to your head just then?
No. That was the actual tune. We started with that show.
Right. Before I saw any musical when I was a kid. On The Simpsons, they're doing Guys and Dolls. They do Star Wars Guys and Dolls, right?
Yeah.
We went on a school trip to see Guys and Dolls when I was at school. And then everyone came off the coach at the end and was like, well, that was an absolute ripoff. They didn't even sing the Guys and Dolls song. And now when I retell that story, people always say, what's the Guys and Dolls song? And in The Simpsons, they sing, Guys and Dolls, we're just a bunch of crazy guys and dolls. Oh, we're guys and dolls. And we all thought that was going to be in the musical because everyone had heard of it from The Simpsons before and everyone was furious. So you have Jenkelson. He's just a bunch of crazy Jenkelson.
Yeah, that was genuinely the song that we had.
We should have gone on a school trip to see Jenkelson instead. We'd have been satisfied.
Mate, I wish you were there. I wish we could go back and get you in the booth.
So do you remember the lyrics? Do you remember the song lyrics?
I do. My sister actually sent them to me. Let me just see if I can quickly find them, because we use that as the just as a parody musical opening, but then it went into verses in between, which were a tune that I'd written, but I can't remember what that tune is now. It's so long ago. So it was Jenkelson, the savior of our world is Jenkelson. He best be making lots of Jenkelson ha ha's and Jenkelson ho ho's. My God, he's really gonna set us free. And then I can't remember the tune for all this stuff, but this is what I'm talking about with so Sashi would come forward and say, well, I was once a regular Jill, but now an alcoholic and on the pill. We were 15, 16. Yeah, we were 15, 16 doing this. Jay Israel, who's a buddy of mine, would then come up and say, I was once a regular Mick with an enormous 20-foot Jenkelson, the savior of our mothers. So it was really bullshitly immature. And I can't remember the rest of that song, but that was the opening of the whole thing.
Big opening.
It was huge.
You've got to open big. You've got to open with Jenkelson.
Exactly.
The next thing we've got here is scene. So how about scene five? We've got a bit of that.
Yeah, so scene five was me being God. So
okay, so you be God. And I'll be God. I'll be the angel.
Yes. Okay, so corner of the stage. So Satan was on, if you were in the audience, to your left-hand side was Satan, sort of in front of the curtain, and I was on your right. None of us were properly on the middle of the stage. We were always sort of just, so the curtain could close and we would come out. So corner stage, God is sitting on a chair. I am God, creator of the universe, Lord of Earth, and I'm bloody bored off my ass. Now, I played it like John Cleese. I wasn't doing it just then, but...
I think you should. I think you should be playing it as John Cleese, please.
I am God, creator of the universe, Lord of the Earth, and I am bloody bored off my ass.
Or could I interest you in a game of darts, ruler of the world?
No, no. Apparently something bad is going to happen unless we get some work done. Bring out the manuscript. Angel hands God a manuscript. God reads the manuscript. Dear me. Apparently somebody's trying to kill me. What am I going to do?
Oh, Lord, you're immortal.
Yes, but he doesn't know that, does he?
I'm sorry, what?
Hold on a minute. This man is Satan. Right, we'll see about that. Let two things be known to all angels. One, Satan may be scheming something very dangerous. And two, I like two lumps of sugar in my tea, not one. So whoever the dirty culprits are, I've got my eyes on you. Lights down. I mean, it's great comedy.
I like the idea that God can't get his cup of tea made correctly, even though he's God, creator of the universe, completely omnipotent.
Yeah, I don't think anything in this, as I said, I was
If he
so
likes
young.
Two sugars in his tea, why wouldn't he just make tea sweeter in the first place?
Because as you're learning very early doors, he's not a very competent god. It's not as simple as what we're told down here on Earth. He doesn't really know what's going on.
Right, you've changed the game, I see.
Yeah, I've rewritten the role of God.
to be a buffoon. And this is long before Bruce or Evan Almighty were on our cinema screens.
I'm still trying to get some compensation for their ripping off my script.
Yeah, of course. I'm still trying to get compensation for my Evan Almighty cinema ticket. So what do we have? We have scene eight. Do you need to... We have a bit of scene eight. We've got enough of it to do. Do we need catching up on where we're at here?
Oh, scene eight. No, scene eight was this weird thing where I had a teacher who would come out and would explain inexplicable moments as if it were a lesson. So he had a sort of a big gown on, and he had a stick. What were those called?
My staff?
No, not like a wizardy thing. Like, you know, like a teacher might point with a...
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. A pointer.
Yeah, a pointer. He'd come out with a pointer and a robe. And I was just shocked that we were able to say stuff like this. So there's a scene just before where God's in heaven, and I suddenly say, hold on to that thought, I need to urinate. And then I turn around and I start peeing sort of off stage. And then I yell over my shoulder, Angel, just out of curiosity, where do the drain pipes of my toilet lead to? And he says, nowhere you need to know. And then my friend Pat would come out, just lean out of the center of the stage through the curtain and go, oh no, it's raining again, and then disappear. And then the teacher came out, who was my friend Xander, who was DJ Comma in the band, in Dime Cross Red, or Illegal 106, as we were also called. Illegal 106, we got the dirty tricks. So he would say, now class, I think it's time I explain to you the religious weather system. You see, when it's raining, God is making wee-wee. When it is windy, God is ridding his system of gastral air, a.k.a. arse mist. And when it is snowing, well, I'll just leave that one up to the imagination. Like, again, you can see why Christian was going gray.
This is unacceptable, yeah.
It's unacceptable. I don't know how we were allowed to do this.
So the audience was people's parents, right?
It was people's parents, it was teachers, it was students. Like, we didn't put any kind of, like, parental guidance or, like, you've got to be of a certain age.
How was this being received?
Oh, it was great. I mean, my memory of it was a great night. It was as perfect a night as I could have hoped for. It was just everything went to plan. All the cues went right. No one forgot their lines. And the teachers were really enthusiastic about it and wanted to put it on in the school afterwards, except Simon was expelled. So he was allowed one Saturday performance, but not a school time performance.
It's just classic Jenkelson.
So the way the story progresses is you've got this main plot where Draxley goes up onto the earth and he starts stealing voices. You have Jenkelson, who's going around and becomes the teacher of the choir so that he can get inside in order to investigate. In order to investigate it and get that role, he kills the teacher, which you find out as he says, I'm the new teacher. And they say, where's the old one? And he lifts a head up behind the desk. And
this is a man who has just been expelled for saying fuck off to a teacher and everyone hates you.
Yes.
And you didn't think, might have to rewrite that bit.
We didn't have time. We didn't have time to do any... I mean, I didn't have time to do a second draft. This was all just off whatever came out of the pencil when I wrote it. So that happens. You got a subplot in between of Albert and Dorothy where he's saying, I love you. She's kicking him in the balls. Leads to nowhere. And then eventually we get to the climatic moment. And had all these weird little characters as well. Whenever that... when he shows that the teacher is dead... suddenly Sashi dressed as a classic opera singer with that sort of horned helmet wearing kind of armor would jump on and say, I'm the opera singing detective and I'm here to investigate this murder. And then someone would shoot her and she would die. I mean, there's a lot of death in there. I think I didn't know how to get characters off stage, so I just killed them in the moment.
That's the power of God. That's someone who's playing God.
Yeah, exactly. And then there were a bunch of songs in between. There was a great one called Doomed, which everyone sang. I think that was my favorite composition. Again, I can't really remember, but it was sort of doomed, bloody doomed. Evil will reign on us. We'll live in hell. Yes, there's nothing we can do. Doomed. Oh, we're doomed. And then each character, the devil would be like, yes, I've done it. Can't believe I've done it. This is amazing. And God would be like, I can't believe I've lost. This fucking sucks. And so that, I think that was my favorite song of the whole thing. And it culminates with the this was a very odd bit of the plot. This was Jenkelson's idea. He wanted an assassin who was a neo-Nazi to come after him, and at the end of the play, the neo-Nazi shoots Jenkelson, who's just retrieved the jar from Draxley. He's managed to get the jar of voices, and he's about to release it 1 hour until this concert's meant to happen. So they think that's why they're singing Doomed, because they're like, it's all over. And he's about to open the jar when suddenly this neo-Nazi comes in to kill him, and he does shoot him in the leg, I think it is, and he drops down. But in dropping, he drops the jar and it smashes on the ground, releasing all of the voices. And that means that everything is saved, and that leads to the ultimate final song of Jenkelson, He Saved Us, reprise right at the end. Yeah.
So shall we save scene? We've got long scene 17 and we've got scene 20. Should we save them for your big finale?
Yeah, let's do that.
And then we'll put some production under and that can play us out, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so Dan, it comes to the time where I'm going to have to score you. I've got to rate you on three different categories.
Okay.
Those categories, if you remember, are originality, pure teen horniness, and Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. How close is it to your work now? Does it show the potential of the future star you've gone on to become? Now, first of all, originality. Look, what we're looking at is a 5 out of 5, pretty close to 5 out of 5. Given that, I've never heard of anything that you've said in this whole podcast. It's not just the work, all the stories. I know that doesn't count, but every aspect of you in this podcast is the most original thing I've ever heard. However, the tune of the Jenkelson song is the same as the Simpsons interpretation of Guys and Dolls.
Yes.
I'll go 4 out of 5 just because of that. Just because
just because
of that tune. I mean, it's fair enough to have copied that. The whole thing is a parody anyway, but 4 out of 5 for originality. Pure teen horniness. You've got stuff about being on the pill in there. You've got a guy getting kicked on the balls for saying, I love you. That snow reference, I think I know what that's referring to. So I've got a pretty much... I mean, there's I don't know if you think there is or not, but I'd say there's some horniness throughout that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot
there's
of horniness.
There's a naked man in the opening scene of your play.
Straight away, yeah.
Of your musical. So I will go... I'm going to go 4 out of 5. Pure teen horniness as well.
Wow.
Do you think that's fair? Is that
big numbers? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's right.
Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose. I mean, I've not seen you do a musical in adult life. I've not seen you do anything. You don't write anything this filthy.
I don't write anything like this at all. I don't do any acting either.
So, I mean, it's got to be a 1. It's got to be a 1 out of 5. It won because of the ingenuity of it and the originality and it being just a mad thing to become obsessed with. I'll give you the 1. But and I mean that in a positive way. But you miss out on the other 4 because, I cannot imagine. It's a big surprise to me that this is what you made when you were younger. I cannot imagine you having made this. So that means you get 9 out of 15. That is a very respectable score.
Wow, great. Thank you.
Congratulations, yeah. And it comes time for me now to read a piece of my own.
Yep.
And for you to score that. Now, this I wrote when I was 17, kind of a similar age, I suppose. Were you how old were you when you wrote yours? 15?
I was 15, 16, yeah.
15, 16. So I was a little bit older than that. And I chose this one today because it's all about time. And I think the opening line of this poem expresses how we all potentially feel in quarantine.
Okay.
Time doesn't really exist. Time's a dictatorial list. What is time but a number that tells me to be awake or a ticking disappearing, letting me asleep today? Time's a distance. Time's a place of inconsistency, a missed assistance. Time is of the essence. Time is a blessing. It's a message just letting me learn a coming lesson. My time is Western. Time is melting over trees. Time is the disease, only cured by eternities. Take time as you please. It's time for me to let time let me be.
That was amazing.
No.
What?
It was not amazing. Do you like it?
I did. I think your delivery as well is I always get confused with poetry because any sort of good or bad poem is just good to me when someone delivers it confidently like you did just then.
I was trying to take the piss out of myself in that delivery, but good to see that you saw that as me going, this is excellent. Well, there's definitely lines in there that are a bit mad. Time's a dictatorial list. Don't know what I meant by that.
Yeah, okay, so time's a dictatorial... Yeah, come on, break it down. What were you trying to get at there?
Well, list rhymes with exist. Mm-hmm. So I know why that word's there.
But what is it? It's a list of numbers, so it's dictatorial because it doesn't break away from the progressive.
Yeah, it dictates what we have to do, and it's in a.
I was thinking as you were singing it. There's a David Bowie song which is Time. Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. It's Rock and Roll Suicide.
Sure.
So I might need to hear some more lyrics again because I started singing that song in my head as you were reading.
Okay. Time is a blessing. It's a message just letting me learn a coming lesson. My time is Western. Little gag in there.
Oh, come on. Pause there. My time is Western. Very nice.
Little gag in there, I think that's meant to be. It's classic 17-year-old Rhys James line here. Time is the disease. From doing this podcast, I've learned that I pretty much use the word disease in everything I write. I didn't mean for that to be that appropriate to what's going on in the world at the moment. Turns out time is not the disease. COVID-19 is very much the disease. But I always use disease because it rhymes with loads of stuff. Time is melting over trees. Now, I'm pleased with that line, I've got to say.
What's that mean? Time is melting.
That is a reference to Salvador Dali, I believe.
Oh, nice.
That's the sort of pretentious wanker I was and am. Time is melting over trees. Just clocks in it. Just clocks. Clocks melting on trees.
Did you have someone like me at school who was liked by the jocks and stuff who could have gone, this guy's fucking amazing. Did you hear this trees line with the
well,
time?
Sorry, when you're saying this, you're assuming that I wasn't one of the jocks. You're assuming that I wasn't the guy who was liked. You're assuming I had to have another guy who would back me up, right? That's what you're suggesting.
What makes you say that?
You said, did you have a guy that could have said your poems weren't shit?
No, I don't think I meant... Yeah. No, I did. Absolutely, that's what I meant. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Was that not you? Were you not that guy?
I was one of the jocks, actually, mate. Thank you very much.
Were you really?
No, not a jock. Not a jock. So I need you to score that poem, if you can, on the same categories. They are, number one, originality out of five.
I don't read too much poetry, so I don't know who you're emulating or stealing from there. I know Sylvia Plath's stuff quite well and Clive James, and it's not like either of those, so I'm going to give you a five for originality.
Yes. Good. It wasn't like two people, so it's really original. Pure teen horniness.
Oh, five.
Oh, yeah?
Reeks of horniness. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the smell that I got if you had to ask for the smell.
Yeah, that's horny. Me. Time doesn't really exist is me going, it doesn't matter that I haven't lost my virginity yet, because there's not even any such thing as time.
Actually, I thought it was more confident. I thought this is someone who's been around. I thought this was sort of you laying on your bed, just going, oh, I dabble in poetry. And time, this one would be the one you'd pull out of the bag.
Like,
here's something
cigarette.
I scribbled earlier. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they'd be like, the Dali reference. I love it.
I can confirm it was not that. It was very much what I said. okay, so two fives. That's pretty impressive. And then the other one is Mickey Mouse Club. How much does it represent who I am today?
Well, the beats of it, I think, represent quite a lot of who you are. You have... They're very one-linery, those lines. I know poetry is broken up in that way, so that's a dumb thing to say. But there's something about, even in your delivery of it... Yeah, I know you're doing a parody of it, but... I felt like, yeah, I was still listening to the Reese I know there. Just it was clever lyrics, stanzas, clever words. Great poetry.
huge Reese, poetry fan.
Great poetry. I would give that a three because for the performance side, the delivery side, would you have delivered it like that when you wrote it?
I just wouldn't have delivered it. There's just no chance I ever would have said it out loud. This is probably the first time it's been said out loud.
Well, it sounds like it's what's sharpened your Twitter one-liner skills, your mock the week, jump into the middle with the microphone, and your stand-up. If time came up on mock the week as a subject, I'd be disappointed if that didn't come out of you.
Fucking hell. Unlikely things to hear from a 17-year-old. Time doesn't really exist. Time's a dictatorial list. I can't wait.
Do it.
If we ever allow to film a TV show again, I can't wait to go in the middle and read that. So that's 13. I get 13 out of 15. So I win the episode 13-9, I'm afraid.
Yes. Nice.
Thank you. I got to say, though, the message of the podcast is we are both losers. There are no winners here. So all that leaves is for you to play us out with the final scene.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. So I've actually, where I left us was the moment where the final big tune comes in, the reprise. So Jenkelson has saved the day. He's stopped evil from taking over. God is happy. Satan is distraught. And everyone has their voice again. So it comes out with this big song. And then we go back to the curtains closing. And it's dark. Everyone thinks the play is over. But then the voice comes over the darkness. And the voice says, "And so is the tale of Jenkelson, Lord Mechanic of Music. Unfortunately, just as the concert ended, a boy named Charlie arrived in town, who was infected with the Black Plague, and within 5 minutes, everyone was dead." Curtains open up again. It shows everybody lying dead on the ground. I think we had Black Plague Charlie standing there, who was my friend Pat, who goes, "Oh no, not again." And then the curtains close. But that didn't make it to the script.
He didn't need it. Didn't need it in the script. It was obvious. It was obvious he was going to do that. Absolutely incredible. Dan, thank you so much. I mean, there's so much to take in from this podcast. People could study this. There's so much. Maximilian is going on. The Art of Loving. Dime Cross Red. Illegal 106. They got the dirty tricks.
We got the dirty tricks.
So there it was, the Dan Schreiber episode of Early Work. What a lot to unpack. Good grief. I mean, you got his dad singing for Imelda Marcos, worried that he's going to get killed because he's involved with some mafia shit, cutting Ringo Starr's beard. You got Dan attending a school in which one of the lessons is to dance around with a gold stick, because obviously, in reality, it's not a school, it's a cult. You got his friend getting expelled days before they perform a musical about him, named after him. Dan playing God, and lest we forget, Maximilian. Absolutely amazing episode. Make sure you follow Dan. He is at Schreiberland on pretty much everything, I believe. Obviously, subscribe to his podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish. Go and check that out if you haven't already. It's from the people behind QI, the elves. Dan is a QI elf. That's why he's so interesting. I mean, it does feel pointless to promote a podcast as big as No Such Thing as a Fish on a tiny podcast like this. That's one of the biggest podcasts in the world. It's definitely one of the biggest in this country. If anything, they should be plugging this. In fact, you know what? It's a fucking disgrace they're not plugging this. They should be plugging this every week. I'm going to get all of them on this and then see if eventually they finally mention it on theirs, and then I overtake them and Early Work becomes the number one. Oldest trick in the book. It's classic. I learned that from Dan, who plays God and likes to humiliate his friends by making them get naked on stage and then calling them ugly in a voiceover. Subscribe to Early Work if you're new. It's loads more stuff like this. Loads of people reading out the things, crazy things they wrote when they were teenagers before they're doing the jobs they do now. Please give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts if you feel like doing that. We're going to continue to bring you lockdown episodes. So I will see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.